Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to the show in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we'll talk about the effect the falling stock market has on our local economy.
And we'll look at how the airline industry is being hit hard by the coronavirus outbreak.
But first, the Phoenix City Council hesitated yesterday to put its stamp of approval on Mayor Kate Gallego's declaration of a state of emergency. On Tuesday, Gallego declared the emergency and ordered all bars to close and restaurants to stop dine-in service. But that declaration must be ratified by the City Council, and the mayor might not have the support of enough council members to make that happen, at least not yet. Yesterday, after a four-hour-long meeting, council members delayed voting on that measure until Friday.
Mayors around the Valley and state are taking similar measures, though Governor Doug Ducey told reporters this week he was not enacting the same restrictions statewide. Tucson and Flagstaff also ordered restrictions on restaurants and bars. It remains unclear if Tempe Mayor Mark Mitchell will force businesses to close there after the city declared a state of emergency last night. Meanwhile, in Glendale, the mayor declared a state of emergency last night as well and is asking bars and restaurants to move to delivery or institute appropriate social distancing measures. He's also asking seniors over the age of 70 to self-quarantine to protect themselves.
And now let's turn to Mesa Mayor John Giles. That city has closed public facilities and canceled events and is encouraging local businesses to abide by federal recommendations and maintain social distancing. The city will not shut off utilities during the state of emergency as well. Good morning, Mayor Giles.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. I want to start with exactly what measures are in place in Mesa. What actions have you taken so far?
Sure. Well, as a city government, we have, as you mentioned earlier, shut most of our city facilities, including parks and recreation, museums, libraries. I'm sure that phone will get picked up.
That's all right.
Okay. Also, as far as the city response goes, programs at our Mesa Arts Center have all been canceled. We're encouraging staff to telecommute. As you indicated earlier, we are also working with the business community, strongly encouraging them and supporting them in their efforts to comply with the CDC recommendations and the Arizona Department of Health recommendations. At this point, we have not mandated the closure of businesses. Our thought is the best way to achieve compliance is to try to work with the business community to encourage and to educate. If we see examples of bars or restaurants or other businesses that appear to be oblivious to the recommendations, we're asking people to please let me and let our city know that so that we can educate and encourage and seek to get compliance in ways other than punitive measures.
What does compliance look like for you, Mayor Giles? Are you talking about having people in a same space but 6 feet apart as the CDC has recommended, or are you encouraging restaurants, et cetera, at this point to move to takeout and delivery?
Yes and yes. As I read the CDC recommendations, it absolutely encourages pickup and delivery for food service. It doesn't prohibit in a facility dining, but it does ask that it be drastically reduced and that the social distancing, you know, be the rule. We have not mandated that. We have I've told the business community that that's our expectation. I think some of the cities that have moved in that direction, I think are have stated that the enforcement of that mandate is something they're not haven't quite figured out. And so I think we want to be very proactive. I'm encouraging people to tell me when they see good and bad examples of compliance. And I'm anxious to work with, I spoke yesterday with the Restaurant Association. They've assured me that they're encouraging their members to comply. And when we see examples of folks that are struggling with that, we want to work with them and educate them and invite them. Certainly haven't ruled out the possibility that at some point this will become a mandate if we see that compliance is not happening.
Well, Mayor Giles, what's the balancing act for you as a resident of the city? Obviously, the economy was doing quite well, and people want to keep that momentum. And this is an act of God, in essence, an act of nature that we couldn't stop necessarily at this point. Coronavirus is something that you wouldn't have had control over. But at the same time, I'm sure there are many residents of Mesa who are concerned, and they hear perhaps mixed messages about whether things should be closed or not. Where does that put you as someone who, yes, is the mayor, but is also a resident of the city? How do you feel about it?
Well, I think we have to set aside being overly concerned with the economy at this point. Where this is a crisis, we have to prioritize public health. But at the same time, once we shut a business down, it's going to be probably unlikely that that a lot of those businesses are going to be coming back into the economy anytime soon. We're going to see a lot of, I think we'll see longer lines at our food pantries, the more businesses that go out of business. So we want to do everything we can to support business. I'm encouraging, part of the messaging that we're sending out is encouraging people, and through social media and otherwise, to please support local business as much as you can. Please go out and get to take out meals for lunch and dinner. Do it responsibly, but let's, to the extent we can, let's support the economy and try to, there's a lot of folks out there that are hourly employees. I mean, the economic impact of this pandemic is already catastrophic. So anything we can do to lessen that impact, I think, is important. But again, the number one priority has got to be public health.
All right, that is Mesa Mayor John Giles. Mesa Mayor John Giles, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And now to hear more about the impact decisions like these have on the people who are directly affected by them, let's turn to Chef Danielle Leone. She owns the Breadfruit and Rum Bar with her husband, Dwayne Allen, in downtown Phoenix. Just a few weeks ago, her career hit a high point when she was nominated for a James Beard Award for her work in the Jamaican-inspired restaurant. But now things are at an all-time low. I spoke with her more about it and her reaction when she heard the mayor's announcement Tuesday.
Yesterday, when we heard the news from the mayor, we knew that it was coming. And in the meantime, at the Breadfruit, we were just taking precautions. We took out tables, so there was 6 feet between all of our guests. We limited it to 10 people per room. We put sanitizer up front. All of our wait staff started wearing gloves, so single-use compostable gloves. We sanitized every pen. We took every precaution possible so we can just keep everybody employed. And then when she announced that restaurants could only go down to takedown and delivery, I knew it was coming, but honestly, it was surreal. Like, you know, in your head, you just feel kind of foggy and your heart sinks. And we thought we were ready, but it was a much bigger predicament to face when the time came than we ever assumed.
So obviously staff is probably the first thing that comes to mind here. Did you have to immediately sort of let everyone go? Are you trying to keep a skeleton staff? Are you trying to hope people will be around whenever you do get the chance to reopen?
So we have such a loyal team at the Breadfruit. And yesterday when that mandate was issued, Dwayne and I, we knew that there's no way that we could afford the payroll liability. And immediately everybody was laid off. We have people that were with us for 10 years. Like for the hospitality industry, that's a tremendous amount of time, that tenure you don't see. And to have to call each one of them and explain that the next thing they do when they get off the phone with me, before they even think about what's next, you file for unemployment because I cannot afford to pay you. Luckily, we have the money in the bank to pay them what they earned for the week before, but we couldn't take the risk of having them come in and not knowing how much business we are going to do. So for instance, we opened last night, opened on Tuesday, and we only served 6 people. I certainly can't employ all 16 people if we only have 6 guests.
So those are difficult decisions to make, difficult conversations to have. Are you hoping that at some point you'll be able to reopen and those folks will still be there?
You know, yeah, of course it's a hope, but is it realistic? I don't really think so. I know we're shut down for 14 days right now. I mean, we're a cash flow business. We cannot afford to stay into business even if we're shut down for 2 weeks. So to say if there's hope to re-employ people, at this rate, without any assistance from our federal government, we don't know how we're going to pay rent, utilities, sales tax. You think of the tax, the payments, we don't have the money for that. And if we're shuttered, I certainly don't have that money to reopen. So where are we left? I mean, we already struggle as small independent operators. Now we're beyond this point of hope. It's almost unrealistic to say there is hope. We need help. We need actual assistance. We need mandates. We need the federal government to come in and say, we see you as a small business owner, and we know you can't afford to renew your liquor license or pay your sales tax. We need people to say that, the government officials to say that, we understand that we have shut you down and it is beyond your hope or your desire to open. We need actual assistance.
Danielle, this comes at a really interesting time for you because you just were nominated for a James Beard Award. This is a high moment in your career. What was your reaction personally?
You know, I have been working towards this goal of getting a James Beard nomination for at least the past 5 years of my life. And to be acknowledged by them is tremendous. And then all of a sudden, everything that I have worked for not just the 5 years, but for the past 13 years at this restaurant, just got ripped away, taken away, and nothing matters anymore. Accolades don't matter. It doesn't matter. None of it matters. The only thing that matters is that we have healthy, happy lives. The only thing that matters to me is that the 16 people that I laid off can afford to feed their families. And I have always taken that for granted, because we have been a success story at the Breadfruit. We're unstoppable at the Breadfruit. Well, we were. We were unstoppable, and we fell so hard yesterday.
Can you understand the rationale behind this in terms of cities doing this around the country, around the world, asking for businesses to survive this hit so that we can protect people's lives?
Yes. Unequivocally, yes. It absolutely makes sense. I am totally for it. Restaurants, bars, we need to shut down. We cannot continue to gather and spread this. However, even though I agree with that, we need to make sure that we have the plan that goes with it. Fine, shut me down. Put me out of business. Make me lay off everybody that's been devoted to me for years and years. But tell me how I'm going to survive too. You can't just rip the rug out from underneath me and then just say, have a safe fall. And the city's not saying anything, the state's not saying anything, and the federal government's not saying anything about it. So I am here just to swallow those losses. And I don't have that kind of money or profit margin to do that. So yeah, close me down, please. I want this to end as soon as possible. Stop takeout, stop delivery. But please, you have to have a plan for us. You can't just leave us here.
Restaurants run on kind of a thin margin to begin with. What do you think the restaurant industry will look like in Phoenix, you know, when and if they can reopen?
When this is over and we're allowed to open our doors, we are going to be left with a disaster still on our hands. We don't get to walk into an office building and turn on a computer. We then now have to figure out, where are we going to get all this money to buy all this food again, right? I didn't generate the revenue. I have thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars of loss in food. I don't have that money. So you let me open my doors tomorrow, I don't have any food to sell you. I don't have any money in my bank account to pay that staff that shows up. And I've got to hope that enough people still feel safe enough to show up, even though there's no mandate. I need the federal government to come in and make sure that people still have incomes. It's not about people being sick and supported. It's about everybody being laid off, even if we're not personally unwell or caring for somebody. I have 100% loss, and I have no way of restarting my business. Right. That's just me, and I'm one of hundreds of thousands.
All right. That is Chef Danielle Leone, the co-owner and chef at the Breadfruit and Rum Bar in downtown Phoenix. Danielle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Over and over, as we cover the coronavirus outbreak, we hear that the elderly and those with compromised immune systems are the most at risk. As a result, many older people in our community are staying away from crowds, largely in their homes. And other places where seniors might find community aren't open. Senior centers are closed. Most churches, synagogues, and mosques are shutting down services. But for a lot of older adults, isolation was a concern long before the spread of COVID-19. So how are they coping now? For more on that, I got a hold of Mary Lynn Kasenick with the Area Agency on Aging.
You know, the older adult has been really listening to the CDC recommendation that they stay away from crowds. I think one of the biggest concerns that we have is they're afraid to go grocery shopping because, you know, there's long lines. And so, you know, they are concerned about how they're going to get food. And what we've been recommending is to see if they have family or friends that can pick up groceries for them so that they will at least have something to eat.
Yeah, yeah. So you think it sounds like most seniors are aware that they should be taking precautions right now, staying away from crowds, et cetera.
I think it's pretty true. I think that's what we're hearing. I mean, I think what happens, though, with older adults not going anywhere, all of our senior centers have closed for group meals. Most of them, though, are having what they call drive-by, where an older adult can come and pick up a meal and take it home. And so we're allowing them to do that and actually encouraging them to do it rather than just say, you can't come to the senior center anymore. I think the biggest concern is being isolated and being lonely. And so we're encouraging older adults to reach out to friends and neighbor and church members, whoever they might know. You know, they can talk on the phone. They could call people. If they're technologically savvy, they could use Skype or FaceTime so that, you know, they can be in contact with each other.
So I know senior centers, churches are often the way that older adults are, you know, maintaining their social lives and getting in touch with other people. So when you're looking at, you know, forced isolation for their own health, what kinds of resources are out there? What are you telling folks to do other than sort of just say, you know, make sure you talk to somebody every day? Are there programs in place for this?
We do have a program called AmeriCorps. And these are older adults, people 55 and over, that are able to do telephone reassurance. And I think some of them are willing to pick up some groceries for older adults. You know, I think the biggest thing is for older adults to let people know that they need help rather than, you know, sit at home and, you know, worry about things. But, you know, just let their neighbors know or let their friends know that, you know, when you go to the grocery store, can you pick me up a quart of milk or pick me up some groceries for the week?
Is that hard for folks to do, though, especially in our society today where often we don't even talk to our neighbors very often?
Yes, yes. That is a problem. And I think also it's tough for older adults to admit that they need help, that they're struggling being alone. You know, and there are safe ways that you can interact with people, like, you know, they could talk through the door or through a window, just as long as they stay about 6 feet away from each other. I mean, the neighbor could even go and pick up the groceries and leave them on the doorstep, and then the senior could, you know, go in and get that. Yeah, these are tough times, and we're trying to come up with alternative solutions to grocery shopping, especially at this point. So we're looking at they can get home-delivered meals, those kinds of things.
Yeah, yeah. So as you're seeing sort of medical experts come out and say, you know, Arizona could see higher death rates because we have a higher population of retired people here in our state, does this feel significantly different, do you think, to older populations than it does to the rest of us?
Well, we know that the CDC and World Health Organization and so forth have said that the population that is most susceptible to coronavirus are people 60 and over. And so I think it's a fair warning for older adults to be particularly mindful, practicing, you know, washing their hands, not going where there are crowds, those kinds of things that help protect themselves from being infected.
That was my conversation with Mary Lynn Kasenick of the Area Agency on Aging. And if you are a senior who's home alone or you know of one, we have resources for you during the coronavirus outbreak on our website. That is kjzz.org. And take a listen to our Hear Arizona podcast to hear those resources in action. We would also love to hear about your experience. Email us and tell us about how this is affecting you. Go to the show at kjzz.org. Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. We start this hour with an update on the spread of the coronavirus and its impacts nationwide. The White House proposed a $1 trillion stimulus package to help avoid an economic collapse in the country due to coronavirus. The proposal lays out half in loans for businesses and half directly to taxpayers. If finalized, the plan would include $1,000 payments for American adults and $500 per child.
Here in Arizona, three more people have tested positive for the coronavirus, bringing the state's total number of cases to 44. That is according to the Arizona Department of Health Services website. Tuesday, Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego and her counterparts in Flagstaff and Tucson ordered the shutdown of dine-in restaurants and bars. Only delivery and drive-through options are able to operate. More cities are expected to follow suit. The Catholic Diocese of Phoenix and Tucson have canceled public masses for the next 3 weeks, and this comes as events in public spaces are canceled and closed. As the state makes moves to stop the spread, concerns increase for the most vulnerable.
Meanwhile, on Wednesday, Secretary of State Katie Hobbs called for the upcoming primary and general elections in Arizona to be all-male elections. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins spoke with Hobbs about the proposal. Jimmy, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So what's the reasoning behind Secretary Hobbs here?
Secretary Hobbs told me she is asking for counties to be able to conduct all-male elections this fall to keep voters and poll workers safe during the coronavirus pandemic. Hobbs said finding enough open and available locations for voting, as well as workers to staff them, has become a challenge and will probably only become more difficult. You know, looking ahead to August and November, we don't know what the situation is going to look like. So in-person voting requires locations and people. And as we saw in the presidential preference election on Tuesday, the county had to close nearly 80 polling locations because there weren't enough cleaning supplies to keep all original sites open. And several site operators were either closed or indicated that they did not want to open for the election.
We've seen more and more people move to mail-in balloting. What would an all-mail election look like?
It would just be like it sounds, Steve. There would be no in-person voting. Everyone would be mailed a ballot just as if we were all on the permanent early voting list. And you would have the option to mail them in or drop them off. Secretary Hobbs told me there could be a physical location in place like a ballot replacement center to help voters with lost or damaged ballots, but that would be about it.
Jimmy, does she have the power to do this on her own, or does she need help from the other branches of government?
No, definitely needs the legislature. Arizona law already allows for cities to do this. School districts can also perform all-mail ballots, but state law does not currently allow a county to conduct a state or federal election all by mail. Counties must provide in-person voting as well. So Hobbs is asking the legislature to change the law to allow for an all-mail election. And in her statement, she made clear that this could just be an emergency action taken by the legislature. It doesn't need to be, or she's not asking for a permanent change.
Now, the legislature is looking to wrap up as soon as possible, maybe as early as this week. So how likely could they actually act on this ASAP?
Well, just as one example, the other day, Representative T.J. Shope tweeted his support for the permanent early voting list, and I'm told that sentiment kind of captures the general House GOP consensus on the matter, that, you know, voters already and for the next several months can easily sign up to vote by mail if they want to. So I do not expect, based on what I heard yesterday, Republican leadership to force any action on this.
Okay. That is KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, thanks as always.
You're welcome, Steve.
It's been a bumpy ride for the stock market over the past several weeks as markets respond to the coronavirus pandemic. The Dow Jones closed down again yesterday after an up day on Tuesday, and that followed Monday, which saw the index's worst percentage loss since the so-called Black Monday in 1987. Our co-host Mark Brody spoke more about this with Adam Kamins, a director at Moody's Analytics.
We've been hearing and seeing the volatility on the stock market over the last couple of weeks. From your perspective, how does this impact individuals like who either are or not heavily invested in the stock market?
Well, individuals who are heavily invested, suddenly their ability to buy things, their purchasing power, their wealth is going to go down considerably. So that's a pretty clear connection. But it flows more broadly through the economy as well. Because if you think about somebody who's invested in the stock market, who's lost a lot of wealth, who feels like they don't have as much money to spend, that will flow into to consumer industries like retail. So if you're somebody who works in a hotel, for example, suddenly, you know, your job prospects look a bit bleaker than they did a month ago, things along those lines.
And for folks who maybe don't have much to do with the stock market, I would imagine that to some extent, what happens on Wall Street affects them as well, right?
That's right. So people who don't have that much to do with Wall Street, their jobs are intertwined with how much people are spending more broadly. So if you have people spending less because they have less money in their 401k, then, you know, that affects the entire economy. And I should mention, too, that what's happening on Wall Street often is not the cause, but it's a symptom. And I think that's what's happening here, is that there's so much uncertainty throughout the economy because of COVID-19, that it's not just the fact that the people are losing money in their stock portfolios, but that there's just uncertainty about everything. And so activity is ground to a halt, and that affects everybody.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because, you know, we hear so often and we're warned so often that the stock market at Wall Street are not the economy. The economy is much bigger and broader than that. But it sounds like what you're saying is, in many ways, what happens on Wall Street, what happens in the stock market, kind of trickles down and affects directly or indirectly many other aspects of the economy itself.
I think that's right. I think what happens on Wall Street can have a lot of effects throughout the broader economy. We look often at, you know, wealth effects and what that means. And people who perceive that, you know, they have a healthy retirement account, for example, are more likely to spend more money. So that does trickle through the rest of the economy. But even though that's absolutely right, that Wall Street is not the economy, the two are very much interconnected. So when you see, you know, sometimes you see fluctuations on Wall Street and they have nothing to do with the broader economy. And actually, that's probably the case more often than not. But what's happening now is what you're seeing in Wall Street is really a mirror into what is happening more broadly economically, that there is concern that probably is bordering on panic at this point.
Are there particular sectors that you are seeing that are being hit harder than others right now?
Definitely. So some of the sectors that are being hit the hardest, probably the biggest hit is to the energy sector at the moment, because not only are you dealing with reduced demand as activity has scaled back, but you're also dealing with an oil price war that is taking place between Russia and Saudi Arabia, and that's pushed oil prices down and made drilling less profitable. So the energy sector has just gotten absolutely pounded. In terms of direct impacts from the virus itself, they're widespread. I would say probably consumer sectors are the ones that are getting hit the hardest. So if you look at consumer discretionary spending, for example, that's been taking a real pounding. And that's probably going to continue for a little bit because people just aren't spending. And even people who are inclined to spend, who aren't that invested in the stock market, they can't spend even if they want to, because restaurants are closing, destinations that people might go to, you can't travel, or you can barely travel at this point. So there's really very little to spend on, even if you're inclined to do so. You know, in Arizona, just as, you know, if you want a little bit sort of a local flavor, I think one of the channels that I'd be looking at closely would be the financial services industry, which has also taken a pounding in terms of, you know, both stock prices and just overall performance as, you know, the kind of financial element of this becomes clearer. And Phoenix in particular relies very heavily on finance jobs, especially back office positions. And those could be vulnerable in the short term. So that's an area that I think I'm watching and could lead to some local impacts.
Let me ask you about the first thing you mentioned there in terms of people maybe wanting to eat out or go places, and they're not really being places for them to eat out and go and spend money. What kind of impact does that have both on the stock market, but also on the broader economy?
Yeah, I mean, it's having a huge impact. And I mean, that is what, more than any other sort of economic channel, I think that's the one that really concerns me. In terms of the stock market, I think that the stock market reflects concern. I think that's why you're seeing consumer-based industries and consumer discretionary type industries, you're seeing cruise lines, airlines, hotels, struggling really broadly. In terms of what it means for the economy, simply put, consumers have powered this expansion. That consumer spending has been what's kept this expansion going as long as it has, over a decade. And that is going to dry up completely now. So it's going to have a tremendous impact on the economy. And that's why, you know, we and most economic forecasters say that you know, as each passing day goes by, a recession looks more and more inevitable.
How much of what you're seeing is psychological, that people are just nervous, they're freaked out to some extent, and, you know, they're stocking up on toilet paper and they're stocking up on whatever they're stocking up on? And how much of it is actual problems in the economy, problems in the stock market that are maybe more fundamental than, you know, mm-hmm. people's just being nervous?
Certainly the toilet paper example is one that baffles me and a lot of other people. That is panic. In terms of the social distancing measures and some of the other measures that are in place, obviously there's a need for all of that. In terms of what is driving what looks like a slowdown in the economy and a possible recession, I think it really is primarily due to the virus itself and all of the measures that have been taken around it. The economy was certainly already in the late stages of its expansion. There were reasons to believe that a slowdown was likely imminent, if not a recession within the next, you know, couple years. But this is not driven by any fundamental imbalance in the economy, the way that, say, the Great Recession was driven by bad mortgages and a housing market that was overvalued. This is driven primarily by a shock. And that shock, of course, is the COVID-19 virus and everything that's come with it.
All right. That is Adam Kamins. He's a director at Moody's Analytics. Adam, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Same here. Thanks.
As more of the country is encouraged and or told to stay inside our homes and only venture out when we really need to, the impact is being felt in a plethora of industries. One of those is the airline business, which is facing fewer travelers and a lot more empty seats. Delta and United have already announced dramatic cuts. Delta is parking 300 airplanes, with United reducing capacity by 50% through May. Joining me to explain more about the impact on airlines is transportation analyst for NPR's Here and Now, Seth Kaplan. Seth, how significant are these cutbacks by airlines like Delta and United?
These are cutbacks unlike any we've ever seen. You know, back after 9/11, in my memory, I remember no airplanes flying above America for a period of a couple of days. So that's true, and that's different from this time when, of course, there is still service. But the difference then is that even though I kind of think of it as airlines slash service, I went back and looked, and, you know, by October, a month after 9/11, service was down something like, I don't know, 15% within the U.S. I mean, that's a big number, mm-hmm. but, you know, there were still more seats than not flying. This time, airlines are, you know, cutting their operations in half, that kind of thing. And who knows how much more, because as much as they're cutting, airplanes are still empty and people still aren't booking flights. So really no precedent for this. I know it's almost become cliche to use that term, unprecedented, but you really can't overstate that fact that this is so much more dramatic than the cuts even after 9/11. Doesn't lessen that tragedy, obviously, but this is at this point almost certainly going to be worse for the airline industry and for people who depend on it for their livelihood and in so many other ways.
What kind of impact do you expect this to have on crews and employees? Will it vary airline to airline, or do you think they'll all end up doing the same thing?
They so far have all done one remarkable thing, which is not yet lay off any employees in terms of direct employees. There's all kinds of other impact because they're not flying on, you know, people who work in airport retail and sky caps and all the rest of it, right? But in terms of their own employees, they haven't laid off anybody yet. 9/11 happened on a Tuesday. By that Saturday, tens of thousands of people were being laid off. It was 75,000 airline jobs in America. Again, just talking direct jobs at the big airlines were gone within weeks. That points to sort of the better situation that these airlines were in coming into this crisis. But again, remember, this crisis is worse, right? So hard to imagine that inevitably some big number of jobs won't go away. Let's see if that becomes part of whatever grand bargain comes out here in terms of some kind of bailout, right? You've got unions saying, hey, keep us in mind. So maybe that's one reason, I mean, aside from the fact that they were just able to wait a little while this time, why airlines haven't made those moves yet is to use that as leverage for negotiations.
What sort of impact could a bailout have if, in fact, the best of expectations are met, where this is disruptive for a couple of months or something like that instead of the rest of the year or however long?
Yeah. In fact, I think if you could assure these airlines that this were, let's say, a 2-month thing and then everything was going to go back, go back to normal, they might not even be asking for all this money, because there are going to be strings attached one way or another. And you asked before, Steve, you know, if the impact varies by airline, and the answer to that is that it does, right? If you are a Delta or a Southwest, to name two of the sort of financially stronger airlines, those are airlines that were absolutely well positioned to get through any kind of normal bump in the road. And most of the other U.S. airlines, even the laggards among U.S. airlines, American, let's say, less profitable than the rest, still in far better shape going into this than it used to be, in far better shape than lots of airlines around the world are. But that's the issue here, is that there's just no assurance of how long this is going to go on. So sure, absolutely. If the government hands these airlines the $25 billion in grants that they're asking for, and then another $25 billion or so in loans, if this were just a 2-month issue, they would, I don't want to say come out ahead, but they would be just fine, and they would pay those loans back quickly. The issue here is the uncertainty. 9/11, I know it's easy for us to say this now because you didn't know this at the time, but that awful first day was the worst day. And then you had recovery, and it was uneven, and then the airlines went bankrupt years later and all the rest of it. But people gradually started flying again, whereas here it's fewer people flying every day.
When we consider a bailout for an industry like this that we rely on a tremendous amount, obviously, to get us places, it's all about adventure or seeing family or whatever it may be, but it's also an industry that has changed so dramatically, and 9/11 did have a big impact on that. People hate going through the security lines. It's a hassle to do this or that, and it's not flying like it was in the old days where it was really a pleasure. In any way, does that impact even the perception of this industry getting a bailout?
I think it does. Everybody's suffering. Every neighborhood business everywhere is suffering. So you certainly can't blame people for questioning why airlines would be getting this special treatment if everybody's suffering just the same. The argument would be that, well, they're systemically important in a way the guy at the Greek deli around the corner from me isn't, right? I remember Ben Bernanke, the former chairman of the Fed, made that argument back when the banks were being bailed out. I think it was, testifying before Congress, he used the analogy, and he did this several times in different contexts. He said, you know, it's as if your neighbor's house is on fire because they were smoking in bed, and you live in a wooden house right next to that house. You know, you could really teach your neighbor a lesson by not calling the fire department, but then you would suffer too. And that'll be the argument here. It is a tougher one to make at a time when the pain is so broad beyond anything we've seen in past crises.
That is Seth Kaplan. Among many other things, he's the transportation analyst for NPR's Here and Now. Seth, good to talk with you. Thanks again.
Likewise, Steve. Take care.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up, we'll hear the story of one Flagstaff resident who was a fixture in the Chinese community in the early 20th century.
My mother died when I was 12, so I didn't really get to know her really good, but she was very kind, very hardworking, very what a wife was supposed to be.
Our Women of the West series continues. That's just ahead on the show.
But first, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey handed out meals to students at Sunset Elementary School in Southwest Phoenix this morning, and he spoke afterward. KJZZ's Brett Jaspers was there and monitored what the governor said. He joins us now. Good morning, Brett.
Hey, good morning.
So you were watching this press conference with the Arizona Department of Health Services director as well, Kara Crist. What did she say about testing?
Well, right. Testing is something that people are really curious about. There's been reports about a lack of tests around the country. And Crist said that several commercial labs can test for COVID-19, but that there is a national shortage of testing supplies and lab reagents. Those are chemical compounds used in the tests. So right now, there's not enough tests for everyone who wants one.
So what do people do?
Well, Crist said that since there's no specific treatment for COVID-19, there's no change in your treatment, whether or not you're positive. Doctors will still care for you in the same way. And so what's really important, she said, was that if you have mild symptoms, and some of the symptoms are, you know, a cough or shortness of breath or runny nose, stay home when you're sick with those mild symptoms, and then for 72 hours after the symptoms go away. Mm-hmm. But you should seek emergency care if you have extreme difficulty breathing, constant pain or pressure in the chest, or severe constant dizziness or other serious concerning symptoms.
So are people being hospitalized for this right now, Brett?
There are people being hospitalized. She said that she was aware of 3 hospitalizations due to the coronavirus here in Arizona.
Okay. We also heard, I understand, from Superintendent of Public Instruction Kathy Hoffman. What did she say about schools which remain closed at this point?
Right. Hoffman said that there has become more flexibility from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and that will allow all schools to offer meals, even if they don't typically do that very much. So if a school, like I said, doesn't necessarily have a robust like meal plan for their students, the USDA is kind of opening up possibilities for them to qualify for some of that food aid regardless. And Hoffman also said that there's a list of schools offering meals at azed.gov. I know KJZZ has an extensive list too of schools that are offering meals. Even one of the superintendents today at this press conference said that they're looking into getting a grant to offer meals on the weekend. So that might be something parents want to see, if there are meals available from their school on the weekend.
Right. And the governor spoke about, I'm sure, other things, but also the economic pain we're feeling. What did he have to say about that?
Yeah, well, he said early on in that conversation that the budget introduced earlier this year will change. He was very clear about that. He was asked by a reporter there about Republican Representative Travis Grantham calling, you know, maybe increased spending, quote, pork. Mm-hmm. And kind of in a, like, he wasn't interested in pork, that something like that is what Grantham said. And Ducey said, we're going to stretch the safety net as much as we can here in Arizona. He was really pretty clear about that.
All right. KJZZ's Brett Jaspers. Brett, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Many experts say the novel coronavirus may have originated with a bat and somehow was able to get into humans. It seems this is how many epidemics and pandemics start, by jumping from an animal host to a human. From WNYC, here's Duarte Geraldino.
Peter Daszak is here to help us understand how this epidemic came about and why there may be more headed our way. Dr. Daszak is president of EcoHealth Alliance, which researches connections between humans, animals, and ecosystems in order to gauge pandemic risk. I asked him about the concept of cross-species transmission.
The ability of viruses to get from wildlife into people is behind almost all pandemics. If we think about diseases like Ebola, like even Lyme disease, those viruses and pathogens are held by wildlife and somehow they get into people. And that's exactly what happened with this COVID-19. The virus behind it is a bat origin virus that was also able to get into human cells and invade our bodies and spread globally.
But do we know how it actually made that jump from bats to humans?
Well, we've been looking at this for about 15 years in China, ever since SARS emerged. And it turns out that, you know, bats are very common, very diverse in southern China. People have an incredible exposure to them. And part of the problem is they fly at night. We don't really see them. We don't see that exposure like we do with other animals. The virus in bats is a fecal transmission. So bats might defecate and someone happens to, unfortunately, it lands in their meal, or even people go and shelter in a cave during the rain, or they're in the wildlife trade. People eat bats across Southeast Asia, and that's a really intimate exposure.
So when we think about that wildlife trade, do you think that it played a role in some way in the transmission of the coronavirus?
It really does look like that. And you know, the wildlife trade is behind a lot of different epidemics and pandemics. It's been involved in Ebola. It was involved in the original SARS outbreak. Wildlife markets in Southeast Asia are incredible places for viruses. People bring diverse wildlife and livestock into the market, keep them alive, and cram them together in cages next to each other. And then people are staying in those markets for most of the day, even into the evening. Kids can come home from school. They're doing their homework next to the animal cages. It's an incredible place for a virus to spread from one species to another, including people.
Just so that we're clear, because people have so many different sorts of pets, what is considered wildlife and what is not. There's that video of Arnold Schwarzenegger who's home feeding his pet donkey. Is that a pet? Is that not considered wildlife?
You know, a donkey or a horse is a domestic animal. It's a livestock. It's been domesticated over thousands of years. And the truth is, there would have been viruses that, for instance, cattle carried, that when we first domesticated them 10,000 more years ago, we were exposed to their viruses and they emerged. But we've experienced most of those. We're now looking at wildlife viruses from bats, from primates, which we make in contact with for the first time. And that's why we're seeing these new diseases. So livestock and domestic animals tend to be safe, but wildlife and our contact with wildlife is driving pandemic emergence.
So what exactly does your organization do in order to try to prevent these types of viruses from spreading?
Well, we very specifically try and get between us and the next pandemic. We go to these places where pandemics originate and we do sampling of people, livestock, farmers, wildlife, and we look for viruses that are relatives of the ones that we've already seen. So in China, for instance, we've been working there for 15 years, identifying and cataloging the coronaviruses in bats, looking for viruses that are like SARS that could be the next SARS. We found over 500 of them, including the closest known relative of the one that causes COVID-19. We work with communities in these places to reduce the risky behavior. We educate them about the risk of having contact with wildlife. We work with governments to try and reduce two specific issues. One, the wildlife trade. Two, deforestation. Land use change is another big driver of pandemic risk.
So how can we keep something like this from spreading? Is it just behavioral modification or is there something else?
Well, right now in a pandemic, we've got to do everything that the CDC and WHO and our state governor and the mayor of New York tell us to do. Social distancing is critical right now to reduce the size of the pandemic curve that we're going to undergo in our local area. And the longer term issue is, how do we stop future pandemics? We've tracked them over time and we can show pretty clearly that they're going to come quicker than they used to in the past. Because we depend on globalized travel and trade so much, they're going to spread quicker. They're going to have a bigger economic impact. They're going to kill more people. We need to get ready to deal with that issue, not just the individual diseases, but the whole process. And that involves a more structural look at what we're doing around the planet in the hotspots for emerging diseases like Southeast Asia, reducing the risk around farming, deforestation, the wildlife trade, global travel and trade. We need to look at pandemics as a product of our human footprint around the planet and insure against the risk of new pandemics from that footprint.
So social distancing may be a key part of the way that we fight the spread of the coronavirus, but are you recommending that even after we get beyond the coronavirus, that we keep our distance from each other?
No, I'm saying that we can go back to life post-pandemic, not quite as normal. I think what we need to do is we need to take heed from this pandemic. This is a big one. This is a disease X, but there are many more coming. And if we don't do things to reduce them, the chance of those new diseases emerging and spreading, we're just going to see more of them. I'm talking about behavior change on a sort of community level, a national level, a corporate level, how we go around the world and build roads into pristine forest areas, send workers in without a food supply. These are risky things to do. Bushmeat hunting is natural in many countries, but at the rate we're doing it, it's going to drive more pandemics. Farming and agricultural intensification in emerging disease hotspots is risky. So let's insure against it. Let's do better surveillance. Let's get ready for these new diseases. And let's seriously look at obvious issues like the wildlife trade as a high risk. Is it worth the risk? Let's talk to people who do this, who consume wildlife, and let's understand why. Let's provide alternatives and let's give them some incentives to do a different behavior.
Dr. Peter Daszak is the president of Echo Health Alliance. Peter, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
That's Duarte Geraldino at The Takeaway, and you are listening to the show. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. As the coronavirus continues to spread, questions about privacy and ethics arise. We've all heard Utah Jazz player Rudy Gobert's name come up as the NBA announced it would suspend games. Tom Hanks and his wife Rita Wilson announced on social media that they had tested positive for COVID-19. But where does someone's medical privacy come into play here? And how do we weigh that versus public safety? What other medical ethics questions might arise as this pandemic continues? For more on that, I got a hold of Dr. Arthur Kaplan, director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU School of Medicine. In a situation like this, where public safety is sort of the central goal, when is it okay to share someone's medical information? And what are the factors that go into making decisions like that?
Well, the presumption is that it's never okay to share information unless it's for medical treatment purposes. And actually, for billing purposes, that's the other way the law reads. So you're not allowed to do it. There are certain diseases that are reportable, sexually transmitted diseases reported to the health department, but that's a very narrow share, child abuse and sexual assault, but they're reported to the authorities. We haven't really put new coronavirus into those categories. I think it would be reasonable, however, to assume that you should be reporting them to the health department, the city health department, county or state. If you have a positive person, that makes sense from a public health point of view. Do you have to tell the media? Do you have to tell the public? Do you have to tell the world? No. But there is a slightly different situation, which is, should hospitals say we've got cases or how many they have? Mm. And I'm going to say yes to that, because there you can do it without identifying anybody. You can just say, last night we had a positive case and they're in isolation and that's what's going on, or we had three cases. And the reason I think that's important is to keep the public trusting that they're not hiding anything.
So I wonder, though, when does sort of the public good come into play here? Because when it's something that is so easily spreadable from person to person, like the new coronavirus, should we at some point disclose to people who may have been in the same space with this person, maybe not who they are, but where they were, at what time, that kind of information?
Well, normally, if you tell the health department, it's their job to then track you down. So that's called contact tracing. If you were in church with this person, if you were in a Kiwanis Club meeting with this person or an Elks Club meeting or something like that, then the health department would track you down. And it's better that they do that, because then they tell you what to do. They say, gee, you don't seem very sick, just stay home for now. Or, boy, you've got some symptoms that are concerning, let's get you down and examined at the clinic or the hospital. So it isn't just a question of a right to know. You want to get counseled about what to do.
So let's talk then about the NBA. They announced last week that they're suspending the entire rest of the basketball season after a player with the Utah Jazz tested positive for the coronavirus. His name came out in some way or another with the coverage of this. What about situations like that, where either someone is sort of outed, or in the situation of like Tom Hanks and his wife, they are sort of publicly announcing that they are people who have this?
I think some people, like Tom Hanks and his wife, may announce it because they're trying to keep people calm. They're saying, you know what, we tested positive. We're going to isolate ourselves. We went to the doctor. We're not freaking out. You don't have to freak out. I think they're sort of setting an example and reminding people, too, that there are going to be a lot of folks infected by this virus who are going to come through it with flying colors. Some won't even get symptoms. So the numbers are going to jump up and continue to jump up for the next few weeks. We're going to move from maybe 1,000 cases. I'm going to say we could have hundreds of thousands of cases in the U.S., tens of thousands in Arizona in 2 weeks. But it's just that the virus has been circulating a long time, and there are plenty of people who had it who didn't get sick. I'm going to give Tom Hanks a little bit of credit and think maybe that's what he's trying to remind us.
Is there a social obligation involved in this? Like, if I started coming down with these symptoms and I stay home from work, do I need to sort of disclose if I were ever tested positive for this to my employer, to people I've been around, that this is what I have and you should watch out as well?
I would. I mean, I think, again, not legal, but if I'm going to be a good colleague and I'm going to work in the office, and by the way, there's a fairly good chance that somebody in my company is going to know, because there's probably going to be an insurance claim that goes into HR that's going to say you got tested or you spent some time in the ER, you know what I mean? Somebody is likely to know within your company, if not your coworker, then maybe someone on the HR side of the street, since we get so much of our insurance through work, that you were positive. So it's the right thing to do as a good neighbor, as a good community member, to say, I have been exposed. It doesn't mean you're going to die. It doesn't even mean you're going to infect somebody else. It's just, that's what happened. We're going to see it perhaps less stigmatized, because as I'm predicting, you're going to see hundreds of thousands of people who are infected, just like in flu season. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to become, you're going to be sitting there saying, if I'm in a group of 25 people, it's for certain that one of them got this virus. That's the bad news. The good news is they didn't get sick. They didn't have symptoms. And then the minor bad news is maybe they could have infected me, depending on how much time I spent with them, where I was.
Last question for you, Arthur. So you study this stuff. You've studied it in past outbreaks. What ethical issues are you anticipating coming up? Or what are we going to be talking about in a few weeks as this continues to spread?
I think there are going to be three big ethics issues. One, panic, because the numbers will go up and people will think, oh my goodness, that disease has taken off and it's just exploding. Whereas all we're doing is measuring what was already there. Mm. So it'll be important for public health people, legislators, the media, ethicists, whoever, to say, no, you don't have to freak out. The numbers are jumping, but it's just because we're doing the testing. We're just measuring something that's been that way for weeks. So you don't have to, you know, worry that somehow this thing is exploding in ways that we hadn't predicted. It's yeah. absolutely predictable. I think there's going to be some concern about what to do with homeless people. You know, if you say social isolation and a person lives in a box on a Phoenix street corner, should they go back there? I mean, literally, what are we going to do? Can we correlate housing policy and find places to put folks who don't have a home or living in their car and that sort of thing? Mm-hmm. And then we do have a lot of folks who are undocumented. It's not an issue unknown in Arizona. So if those people are afraid to go to the doctor, but the thing to do is to get in there and then get isolated, get diagnosed if you are infected, can we make an amnesty or some policy that says, don't worry, we're not going to deport you if you show up at the hospital? I think those issues are going to break out.
All right, lots to watch for there. That is Arthur Kaplan, Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU School of Medicine. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And this is the show.
And now it is time for another edition in our Women of the West series during this Women's History Month. Arizona boasts of many women who've made history both here and on the national stage. We all know the impact that Sandra Day O'Connor and Rose Mofford had here, but in this series, we highlight some of the lesser-known women whose stories shaped our state's history. Today, meet Du Yu Wong. She wasn't a politician or an adventurer or relatively famous. Du Yu was a Chinese immigrant to Flagstaff during the turn of the 20th century, when the Chinese Exclusion Act was law. She and her husband opened the American Laundry in Flagstaff in 1915, a business that by the time she died had become a pillar in the community. And for this interview, we got an especially up-close and personal point of view to tell us a little bit about her story, her sons. Here is my conversation with Dr. James Wong, a now 85-year-old retired doctor and the last child of Du Yu. He began by telling me how his parents met.
Well, most Chinese who were here were married by prearranged marriages. In those days, the women were raised to marry a rich American, and there were a lot of eligible Chinese women. And my mother was only 16 when he went to get her, when he went to meet her.
So your father went from San Francisco to China to meet your mother, and they married there. And then it was a while later before she could come to the United States, right?
Yes. And that was at that time because of the aftermath of the Chinese Exclusion Act. One of the restrictions was they could not bring their families to the U.S. Even though my father was a citizen of the U.S., they still you had to jump through a lot of hoops to bring them over here.
How did she end up getting through the immigration system despite the Chinese Exclusion Act to come here eventually?
Well, You know, the Chinese Exclusion Act was enacted. It was an actual law in 1882, and was reenacted in California in 1892. And actually, the law was used to restrict the Chinese in every way for 60 years. My father was aware of the laws and the laws changes, and until finally he had a valid birth certificate and other papers which would allow him to bring his family over from China.
Hmm. So when they came, when your mother came here, they settled in Flagstaff. Well, why Flagstaff of all places, first of all?
Okay, my father lived his first 17 years in Chinatown in San Francisco. He never left the boundaries of San Francisco Chinatown. And the way he got to Arizona is because they were hiring Chinese laborers in the low-producing gold mines in the Prescott area. Hmm. And he heard that they were hiring, and he got a job there for $2.50 a day. And they deducted a dollar for room and board. So he worked in this mine, not as a laborer, but he worked as actually a cook until the mine ran out. And the way he got to Flagstaff is because Flagstaff was a bigger town, and he could figured he could make more money and settle in Flagstaff. That's how he picked Flagstaff to settle in.
So when they settled there in Flagstaff, your parents, what was it like for Chinese immigrants at the time? There, I understand, was a pretty big Chinese-American community there, but you're also living under, you know, a time when the Chinese Exclusion Act was law, so there must have been a good amount of discrimination.
Well, you know, my father, he was aware of the Chinese Exclusion Act all his life because he was born the day they enacted the law, and he grew up with it. And he found ways to live within the law and work hard. That was his philosophy. But there was a lot of discrimination of the Chinese everywhere.
I understand there were fires in Flagstaff at some point during your parents' time there, and the Chinese-American community was blamed for those?
Yeah, they were blamed for it, but it was an effort just to get them out, to drive them out of Flagstaff. You know, the Chinese weren't the only ones to be discriminated in Flagstaff. Mm-hmm. And as long as my father, you know, our business was on the south side of the tracks, and as long as you worked hard and didn't make waves, they tolerated us, and not me necessarily, but my family.
Tell me about the laundry business. It sounds like it, by the time, you know, it was well established, was quite a pillar in the community.
Well, you know, the Chinese were stereotyped. You know, you were either a servant or a cook or a laundryman. And my father fell into the laundry business because there was a need for it.
So you and the rest of your siblings were born and lived right there above the laundry?
Yeah, my mother had, she bore 10 children. She had a baby every year or two. And most of us were born on the second floor of the laundry. And we all lived together with one bathroom, and we all worked.
What is it you remember most about your mother?
Well, my mother died when I was 12, so I didn't really get to know her really good, but she was very kind, very hardworking, very what a wife was supposed to be. She felt that if she worked hard, and my father taught her to live within the law, and that you would be rewarded in your life and your afterlife.
One thing I read about your mother was that she never was able to obtain citizenship in the U.S., even though she lived there for so long, even though she tried to. Why not?
When my father died when I was 6. She inherited the estate, but she could not own it. And this is another restriction in the Chinese Exclusion Act, and it stated that if she was not a citizen, she could not own her own property. So the family decided that she should become a citizen. And because she could not read, write, or speak any English, the first question on the citizenship test in those days was that you had to recite the preamble to the Constitution. And every one of us, even me, tried to get her through this preamble, and she could not get past the first 10 words, literally.
So she came to America at a young age, had this large family here in Arizona, and her legacy lives on through you and your siblings, and I'm sure your children, and on, right? But
right.
Give us a sense of what you think her legacy is.
She did what was necessary to raise a good family and provide for them in every way, and she did it to the end.
All right. That is Dr. James Wong, son of Du Yu Wong, a Chinese immigrant in Flagstaff at the turn of the 20th century. Dr. Wong, thank you so much for coming on the show to tell us about your mother.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.